Well, thank you so much for coming tonight. It's a pleasure to be here in Beijing. It's a pleasure to be amongst you. It's a pleasure to see some familiar faces in the audience. My topic tonight is why Crimea is a problem and Scotland isn't. So the talk is really about the problem of secession, and I'm going to use the recent experience in Crimea and contrast it with the experience in Scotland. While Scotland is of concern in UK domestic politics, it doesn't seem to have quite the same resonance amongst great powers in the way that the situation in Crimea does. I'm not aware that the US or the Chinese authorities have seen an issue with Scotland seceding from the UK Union. But the question, why is Crimea a problem and Scotland isn't, is an interesting one, because not all the great powers, leading international, leading states, have taken such a lack of interest in the situation in Scotland. If we turn to the opening question, why is Crimea a problem and Scotland isn't? It's reportedly the question that Vladimir Putin asked of David Cameron when Putin recognized the results of the Crimean referendum following the collapse of the Yanukovych regime in Kiev. Now, Putin has an interest, obviously. He's a party in this dispute, so he's hardly a neutral observer, and many will no doubt regard his threatening response to the integrity of an independent Ukraine as both dangerous and cynical. And we can see some of that reflected even today in the British press's reporting of the apparent appearance of Russian forces in eastern Ukraine supporting the illegal occupation of state buildings. So Putin reportedly asked this question of Cameron. Cameron came into line with the European Union and the US in imposing sanctions on key figures in the Russian regime following their recognition of the Crimean referendum for reunification or separation from Ukraine, reunification with Russia. So in one sense it's a cynical question, but in another sense it raises quite important issues about the status of secession, about referenda, about how we draw borders, about recognition. And I want to explore some of that through the contrast of the two cases. So I'll say a little bit about Crimea first, and then I'll go on to describe the details of the Scottish case, and then say something general about the consequences of the idea of secession and its place in international politics. So the Putin regime in Russia has a strong reason to undermine the position of a successful and independent republics on its borders. It also has a long history of competition with Ukraine, the history of the Yanukovych regime and the struggle against Yulia Tymoshenko has meant that Russia and Ukraine have been in struggle for authority and primacy in the region since pretty much the Ukrainian Republic became independent from the USSR, the former USSR, on the 21st of August 1991. The recent struggle in Ukraine has its roots in a decision in 2010 of the Constitutional Court in Ukraine, which overturned a series of constitutional amendments going back to 2004, which had led to a transfer of authority, or some significant authority, from what was originally a presidential to a more parliamentary system. So the giving power to Parliament became part of the issue that has led to the subsequent instability in Ukraine. Partly because of the personality of the president, Yanukovych, who comes from the Russian supporting, or it has his power base in the Russian supporting eastern part of the Ukraine, whereas the parliament reflects the diverse balance of authorities across this complex country. In 2010, the Constitutional Court, which has the authority to do this, overturned the amendments of 2004, re-empowering the president to assert authority over Parliament and over the country. Now that raises personal problems about the character of the president and about the standing or authority of the Constitutional Court, which is seen to be in the pocket of forces that are not sympathetic to the position of the more westward-looking Ukrainian national elements in Ukrainian politics, who are keen to establish connections and eventually seek recognition within the European Union. This process has continued. On the 22nd of February, Parliament dismissed Yanukovych. He subsequently fled, re-emerged in Russia. It installed a new parliamentary speaker and Arseniy Yatsenyuk as interim prime minister. Almost immediately following this, the government of the autonomous region of Crimea, Sevastopol, announced a referendum, which was held on the 16th of March, on whether to secede from the Ukraine and to join Russia. When the referendum was announced, it was immediately denounced in the West as illegal and non-binding. It was denounced in similar ways by the Ukrainian regime and by its backers in the US and the EU. One of the reasons given for rejecting the referendum was the haste within which the referendum was being organized and carried out. But the organization of the referendum was actually rather a spurious objection, as the government of the autonomous regime had already prepared for such an eventuality for quite some time. And some of those who denounced the referendum would not have supported a plebiscite on secession under any circumstances at all. And that's something I'll come back to. So the Crimean referendum took place on the 16th of March. The question that was asked, in fact, there were two choices presented on the ballot. The question is always problematic in these cases because it tends to be leading. The voters were offered two choices. Choice one was, do you support the reunification of Crimea with Russia with all the rights of the Russian Federation? So the key word here is, do you support the reunification of Crimea with Russia with all the rights of the Russian Federation? So the recognition of a status that had been abandoned but was a return to the appropriate state of relation between Crimea and Russia. Second question was, do you support the restoration of the Constitution of the Republic of Crimea in 1992 and the status of Crimea as part of the Ukraine? So in both cases, the choice is one of restoration, but restoration to what? Now, here's the votes for choice one, 97%, votes for choice two, 2%, and invalid votes, about 1%. Exact figures are 96.77, 2.51, and 0.72, on a turnout of 83.1%. So, pretty resounding turnout in favor of choice one about supporting reunification of Crimea with Russia. Now, that outcome shouldn't have been a great surprise, given the demography of the autonomous region as a whole. 60% of the population of Crimea, Sevastopol, is 60% ethnic Russian, 24% Ukrainian, just over 10% Tatars. And in all, 74% of that population are native Russian speakers. And if you look at Sevastopol itself as a city, 71% are Russians, 22% are Ukrainians, 94% are first language Russian speakers. All that said, if you look at the polling that was done at various stages prior to this referendum, so over a period of years when the question of the status of Crimea in Ukraine had been asked, you get rather different results. In fact, the polling data is a bit all over the place, depending on the sample, depending on the polling organization, and depending on the questions asked. Nevertheless, the case of Crimea was always going to be problematic. From a geographical point of view, the peninsula is almost an island, with only a very narrow isthmus connecting the main landmass to the rest of Ukraine. Historically, the region was always semi-autonomous and only became part of the Soviet Republic of Ukraine in 1954 at the gift of Khrushchev, at a time when this actually meant very little because of the central government's domination of the former Soviet republics. The central government transferred populations, hence the large ethnic Tatar community, and the very large Russian and Russian-speaking populations. The other important fact about the Crimean Peninsula, as many of you will know, is also the main base for the Russian Black Sea Fleet, and therefore a base of very large Russian military presence. A somewhat curious position for a part of an independent Ukraine. So what are the consequences of the referendum? The international community has ignored the outcome, with the US and the EU leading and imposing targeted sanctions on Russian administrative figures, particularly those close to Putin himself. He has, however, recognized the decision of the people. Now, the ostensible reason for ignoring the decision of the autonomous region, despite the numbers in the vote, is that the region has no right to secede. There is no right to secession in international law, and there is no provision for secession within the constitution of the Ukrainian Republic. International law, domestic politics, do not allow for secession, so it cannot be allowed. But as I say, the position of the international community is not wholly clear, as is illustrated by the example of Scotland, which, as I say, is far less of a cause for concern amongst the international political community, albeit that the Spanish have raised some concerns about the precedent it might set for Catalonia or the Basque region. So let me say a little bit then about Scotland. Scotland, for those of you who don't know, is an independent kingdom in the British Isles and has been from the early Middle Ages. In 1603, James VI inherited the crown of England and Ireland following the termination of the Tudor line with the death of Elizabeth I. And this began a process that led to the formal union of the two crowns in 1707 and the beginning of the United Kingdom of Great Britain as a unitary state. There followed a period, several decades, in which that union was reinforced by military action and the transfer of the crown to a German family was imposed on the Scots, who still thought that their royal line was in existence. Now, all that is part of an early modern process of state formation. Great Britain becomes a complex state through a long and complex historical process. But it's important to remember that it wasn't a peaceful process. So although now we think of the Union of Great Britain, England and Scotland as being kind of given and safe and all part of the history of the emergence of a stable democratic institution, it was not always so. The other important part about Scotland is that it has retained a very distinctive political culture. It has a distinct national church, Presbyterian as opposed to Episcopalian, a different legal system, a version of the civilian or Roman law tradition as opposed to the common law tradition dominant in England. It has a distinctive higher education system. It has four ancient universities, whereas England only has two. Scotland has been and remains a very unique political entity. In the UK Parliament, Scotland is disproportionately represented given its population size relative to the rest of the UK. Far more representation for Scotland than for most other parts of the densely populated south of Britain. So although Scotland united with England, becoming part of Great Britain as a unified state some time ago, and it has ceased to be anything other than an Anglophone culture, it has remained a distinctive civil and political culture with distinctive civil and political institutions, which in other respects would mark it out as the basis for a distinct political entity, a claim to be a state. And indeed, for many decades, the Scottish case for devolution within the Union or independence without the Union has been based on precisely the claim that it is not a cultural nation, although it does have a distinctive culture, but it is a political nation, effectively a state in waiting that manifests all the features short of state sovereignty. So there's been clamour amongst some within Scotland for independence. In the late 20th century, the Scottish National Party had grown from a small and vocal minority to a significant force in Scottish politics. In the late 1970s, in 1979, there was a referendum on devolution, greater powers being transferred to regional representation and institutions. In the 1979 referendum, 51.6% of the population voted in favour of greater devolution, but given that there was a 40% rule that there must be a 40% of the majority of the total electorate, that was then regarded as insufficient to justify the establishment of a Scottish Parliament, as it translates into only 32.9% of the total electorate. So the referendum was set up to make it very, very difficult for devolution to succeed. That task was finally completed following 1997 with the establishment of a Scottish Parliament, but then begins a process for further extension of devolution, which has led to the establishment of a nationalist administration in Scotland, despite the structure of the Parliament being set up for there to be no easy majority in the Assembly. The Scottish National Party became a majority party, and insofar as they were now the majority party, were able to put in place their manifesto commitment to hold a referendum on independence. Now, the interesting thing about the relationship between the Scottish situation and Crimea is that even in Scotland, a referendum on secession or secession itself is illegal. Scotland does not have a right under the United Kingdom's rather curious constitution to exercise the claim for independence. The United Kingdom Constitution reserves foreign policy and the status of the Union to the Parliament in Westminster. So the Scottish nationalist regime in Scotland was simply going to go ahead with having a referendum that had no legal status, not dissimilar to what the Crimean Regional Authority also decided to do against the Constitution, just to go ahead with a referendum. The response of the British government, though, was rather different. Rather than have an illegal referendum take place, British Parliament engaged in negotiations with Scottish Parliament, and through an order in council under the Scotland Act of 1998, transferred the authority to hold this referendum on a temporary basis. So the British government, unlike the Ukrainian government, just chose not to put an obstacle in the way of a Scottish referendum. And indeed, one of the reasons it did that is, what would it have done to stop the Scottish government from doing this? Arrest the Scottish government, confiscate ballot boxes, shut down polling stations, bring out the police and the armed forces. That was never going to happen. So the Scottish regime was able to call the bluff of the Westminster Parliament. This may not be legal, but in terms of the politics, they had no choice but to do what the Scottish Parliament asked. So, we have a referendum coming up on the 18th of September 2014. This allows for a much longer campaign, admittedly, than the campaign in Crimea, which was only 2 weeks long. And we won't know the outcome of that until after September. September is a very odd time to hold elections. Generally speaking, in the United Kingdom, you don't hold elections in the summer period. Parliaments and the institutions of government are in recess, everyone goes on holiday, and nobody's around. So the two points at which you have elections are late spring or early autumn, no later than the beginning of November. People are at home, they're available, and the parties can just... No one really knows what will happen in September. Will anybody turn out? It's also difficult because it's outside of the political cycle, so all the politicians are away. Will they be campaigning as a result, or will this happen sort of independently? So we're not quite sure what will happen there. But some other interesting features of the Scottish referendum are worth pointing out. The British Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition in the Westminster Parliament have chosen not to be involved and have left the referendum to be handled by either Scottish figures or other political figures who are not part of the national, or not office holders in the national parties. Now, this is a wise move in many respects. It's left the campaign to be dominated by the Scottish, so they own the decision. It allows the British government and the opposition in the British government to reserve its position on what attitude it will take in the event of a different outcome, of the different outcomes to the referendum. But at the same time, it has allowed the dominant figure in Scottish politics, Alex Salmond, to dominate the debate. Okay, some other features of the referendum. The question, remember in the case of Ukraine, two complex questions reverting to a previous situation. In Scotland, the question is simply, should Scotland be an independent country? Simple, ambiguous, independent. What does that mean? Secondly, the electorate has changed. Those who can vote. We have British citizens who are resident in Scotland. So anybody resident in Scotland, legally resident in Scotland, gets a vote. Citizens of the 53 Commonwealth countries who have a right to reside in Scotland are also given a vote. Citizens of 27 EU countries resident in Scotland are given a vote. Members of the House of Lords who are resident in Scotland have a vote in this referendum. Generally, we have a rather curious system. We still have a House of Lords, and they don't vote in general elections. But members of the House of Lords are allowed to vote in this referendum. And then members of the UK Armed Forces registered and stationed in Scotland get a vote. So the interesting thing is why this has happened. The other important point is that Salmond has campaigned for the voting age to be reduced to 16 from the normal voting age of 18 in this election. The gamble being that apparently young people will vote for more radical options, and this will cancel out the effect of the elderly, who are the most likely to vote, but who tend to be more conservative in their views. So there is some playing about with the franchise to get the decision. But going back to the main criteria of who can vote, we see that it is basically going to be a territorially bounded electorate. And this has raised all sorts of challenges. What about Scottish nationals who are resident in other parts of the United Kingdom? Should they be given a vote? No. So it's only those who are resident and have rights to vote in Scotland who will vote, whether or not, in any national sense, they're Scottish. It's a political criterion of eligibility. The other point is that there have been various challenges as to whether or not a vote that affects the constitution of the union should actually be opened up to all members of the state. And this reflects one of the issues that was raised about the situation in Ukraine. Should the question of Ukraine's position in Ukraine, Crimea's position in Ukraine, be a matter for the entire Crimean electorate, or should it only be for a particular section? And the argument in the Scottish case is that territoriality is what matters, because it gives credibility to the outcome. And there is a precedent for that. So, parallels. Both are of dubious, or at least contestable, legality. The Scottish case is only legal because of a special provision to recognise this temporary transfer of powers to the Scottish Parliament, and to give legal cover for what the Scottish Parliament was going to do anyway. But even here, there still remains the possibility of legal challenge. There is still some question as to whether there will be a legal challenge to opening this up to all Scottish people resident of the United Kingdom. And as this is only an advisory referendum, it's open to the UK Parliament to decide how it responds to a straight majority in favour of independence. It's not obliged to recognise the outcome, it's only obliged to recognise the possibility of holding the vote. So there's no commitment to the outcome, whatever happens. Like Crimea, Scotland already has considerable autonomy within the British state, including the Legislative Assembly, and quite a bit of devolved sovereign powers. Unlike the Ukraine, Scotland is monolingual, and although there are social and ethnic cleavages, they do not track any easily distinguished conceptions of nationality. Both have a historical legacy of independence from the state in which they are now finding themselves apart. So those are similarities. What's the obvious difference? Russia is the obvious difference. So go back to the original question, what's special, what's distinctive between Crimea and Scotland? The answer is simply Russia. But this then raises important questions about how we should think of rights to secession, whether there are such rights, and how we respond to claims for secession. The idea of secession is a deeply controversial one. There is, as I said earlier on, no specific, either general or special right in international law to secession. And to take just three examples, the US, China, and Russia, all are deeply uncomfortable with the idea of secession. Not surprising, as they're all very large, multi-nation states with a history and a concern about their integrity, and where that integrity and structure has been deeply contested. The US has a problem with claims to secession wherever they arise, partly because of its own political constitutional settlement. The United States fought, remember, a vicious civil war against secession by the Confederacy in the 1860s. And it is unlikely to ever recognize a right to secession that would be binding on the Constitution of the United States. So there will never be a universally accepted universal right of secession in international law while the United States remains a significant power. If that ever happened, it would provide a challenge to the federal structure of the United States, in particular the right to secede. The Union would then turn into the Confederacy that it fought against in the 1860s. So the US has a historical reason for being opposed to secession in Scotland or Crimea. China is more complex. It is a unitary state, not a federation, though it shares many of the features of what we might consider a federal state, but with a very, very strong center. As much of China's history in the 19th and 20th century has been shaped by challenges to its territorial integrity, and where that challenge to its territorial integrity and the unity of it has been compounded by external intervention, it's unlikely that China will also ever be comfortable with a right to secede. But what about Russia? Surely Russia is generating the cause for concern in encouraging secession in Crimea and in eastern Ukraine, just as it has done in North Ossetia against Georgia. So my point is that all three countries are against a institutionalization of a right to secession, but Russia is apparently supporting the secession of Crimea from Ukraine and apparently encouraging secessionist claims from other parts of eastern Ukraine. But there is an interpretation of Russia's position which also reinforces its hostility to the idea of secession, despite what seems to be happening in the Ukraine. And that is, this suggests that Russia is exploiting a position on secession that it was never in favor of, and in order to show the implications of a secessionist strategy, and most importantly, to encourage counter-secessions. So in order to see that as being the driver of Putin's concerns, you have to go back to the breakup of the former Soviet Union, which was a union of states. It did, in principle, offer states the possibility of leaving the union, but as with unions as opposed to confederacies, it left the exercise of those rights at the discretion of every other member of the Union. So there was no real right for any of the Soviet republics to secede from the Soviet Union. Once the central power in Russia and USSR collapsed in 1991, the Soviet Union itself broke up. It broke up, one, because of powerful regional interests taking former Soviet republics into the realm of independent states, but most importantly, it broke up because Western powers and other powers were prepared to recognize the independence of those states once they claimed statehood. So the issue here is recognition. Those with long memories, and I suspect Putin is one of them, will be very conscious of that. The West recognized unilaterally the breakup of a union. All all that is happening from the perspective of Putin's regime is the extension of that logic of secession by the recognition of counter-secessions. If Ukraine can secede from the USSR, Crimea can secede from Ukraine. Secession is possible, then anybody who asserts a claim to secession that is recognized by another power has a right to secede. So the key point in why Crimea is a problem, of course, is because Russia has an interest in recognizing the fact that the West would like not to happen. And if one is against secession, then one has to be consistently against secession, not just when secession happens in places that it's convenient to happen, where it weakens states you don't like, but where secession is recognized as a matter of right. So what are the arguments for political secession? Why wouldn't one think of secession as being the kind of right claim that a nation or a political group might wish to assert? The most common grounds for thinking that there should be a right to secession is to link secession to claims for national self-determination. If nations are real, if nations are valuable, then nations should have some political freedom to exercise that value, and where that is not recognized in terms of an autonomous or distinctive political community, it allows for, or it gives an argument for, seceding from a dominant community to assert itself. And this is the kind of idea that underpins the Wilsonian doctrine of nations coinciding with states. It goes back to an interesting idea of John Stuart Mill, the English utilitarian philosopher in the 1860s, where he writes, "A portion of mankind may be said to constitute a nationality if they are united amongst themselves by common sympathies which do not exist between them and others, which makes them cooperate with each other more willingly than with other people, desire to be under the same government, and desire it should be governed by themselves or a portion of themselves exclusively." So Mill links nationality with effective statehood, and then many have taken that argument to link statehood with effective nations. So nations that can assert their will ought to become states. The interesting thing is that Mill's argument goes in one direction but not the other. Mill thought, in functionalist terms, that nations were a good idea to sustain stable political communities without the need for significant coercion. He didn't think that every nation should actually be a state. In fact, if you read Mill's account of nationality in chapter 16 of Considerations on Representative Government, Mill says quite a lot of disparaging things about lots of nations that history has passed over. He thinks the Bretons can't be a nation. France is going to be a nation. France is the powerful element, and they should either join it or be discarded into the dustbin of history. Mill didn't think Ireland stood a chance of being a nation, certainly didn't think Wales should be. He probably wouldn't have supported the idea of Scotland as a nation. Britain is a nation because it is the kind of powerful functioning state that national identity should fill. So the idea of nation is something that is a functional benefit for states being effective. It's not a claim for rights. So any group that identifies itself as a state, as a nation, doesn't necessarily have a right to secede. What's the other arguments for secession? Associated with the case of the Confederacy, for example, in the United States, you would have possibly a consent argument. Political authority is composed of the rights of individuals who legitimize the exercise of state power. Consent is a condition of states being real, and that is pulled from the rights of individuals. So individuals make states. If individuals find their rights not recognized by the state they're in, they can reconstitute themselves as a different state. So this consent argument seems to suggest that secession and counter-secession is exactly the kind of thing that the political regime that recognizes the rights of individuals should result in. But the problem with that view, and why people find it so problematic, is that it gives a very curious, unstable account of state legitimacy. It distinguishes state legitimacy from territoriality, and it seems in good philosophical style to be explaining something rather different from the real world of political societies. It creates chaos where the desire is to have order. The third and final main argument for secession that is often used is that it's a response to injustice and oppression. This was a common use of the idea in applied to the case of former Yugoslavia. Small states, statelets, secede in order to protect themselves from domination by larger ones. So think of the arguments about the position of Kosovo in relation to Serbia. Kosovo was unsafe as part of Serbia, therefore it should have the right to secede from Serbia to protect itself against a dominant population that was going to perpetrate injustice. However, in those cases, secession doesn't seem to be the sort of thing that gives real security. Think precisely about the case of Kosovo in relation to Serbia. If the problem is your powerful neighbor next door and you're weak, then some transfer of legal right is not going to help you unless you have the power to enforce those legal rights against others. And this is where we come back to the situation of Ukraine and Crimea. Crimea is able to assert its right to independence because there is one really, really big power that is going to recognize it. And that power is nearby, and that power will support that claim of right. Anybody else who is going to assert that right is going to run up against who or what would recognize it, who would bear the costs of recognizing the claim of subgroup secessions. And this will increasingly be the kind of problem that Scotland faces. It's all well and good for a little statelet to assert its independence. Currently, the UK Parliament, the British state, is happy to accommodate that decision. But once you get to asserting your right to independence, even if that's a large vote in the summer, we'll see how powerful that claim actually is. So making a claim and being able to assert a claim is the key to the problem of secession. Crimea is able to make a claim and assert that claim. Ukraine is able to make a claim. It's not clear that it's able to assert its claim against secession because of the costs involved. So the Russians are simply reminding the West and everybody else about how a system of states' rights that include the right to secession works, and the distribution of benefits and costs that go with it. So let me just wind up with some reflections on what's likely to happen. Crimea is a done deal. No one has either the interest or the resources to invade and impose integration and uniformity of Crimea with the rest of the Ukraine. Russia has asserted its interest in maintaining a dominant political link with Crimea, and the population, by and large, are comfortable with that. More troubling is what happens with the Russian population in eastern Ukraine, and here it's not clear whether Putin wants to support further secessions or whether he simply wishes to remind those around of the costs of the dismemberment of a large state. The costs of the dismemberment of Russia, Soviet Union, can be replicated in the position of Ukraine. So it's a reminder to the Ukrainians about constitutional reform and an encouragement to respect federation. Self-determination comes at considerable cost. No one is ever totally free, whether as an individual or a polity. And Ukraine is just too close to Russia for it ever to enjoy anything other than qualified independence, something that China's neighbors might also give some consideration to. So rights in the international realm are therefore of limited significance. The system of rights needs to be recognized and sanctioned. Asserting rights is easy, but having them recognized is more complex and depends on others. In Scotland then, what's going to happen? My prediction is that the referendum will be close, but the outcome will be no. No to the request for greater independence. Why? Simple reason. If you look at clan family names and the distribution across the country, the United Kingdom, in the early part of the 20th century, you will see them concentrated in Scotland. If you look at them now, they're everywhere. So Scottish voters would effectively be voting to impose a border between family members in a small state. Does that matter? My sense, my gut feeling, is actually the nationalists don't care if they lose the referendum. They had a referendum as a manifesto commitment. They're having a referendum. They'll win on that. They've done what they said they would do. They won't win the referendum, but they'll come quite close. My guess, it will be quite close. And people will support greater independence, but not sovereign independence. And this will benefit the Nationalist Party. Central government will take the view that they'll take a view of relief at the integrity of the union being asserted. They'll have drawn the sting of Scottish Parliament, and then the wiser heads in the Conservative administration will reduce the representation of Scotland in the Westminster Parliament, damaging the Labour Party significantly and advantaging the Conservative Party in return for much greater regional devolution, which is independence, which is actually what's being asked for in the referendum. Independence is left ambiguous. They didn't use the sovereignty word, they talked about independence. And what Scotland will probably end up with is independence in all relevant respects except for currency and fundamental control of their economy, foreign policy and security and defence. Everything else will gradually devolve to the functioning Scottish Parliament. My sense is that that's what the nationalists know, and either way they will win. If they actually had a yes vote for the referendum, that could be rather more complex. In those circumstances, the Scottish Parliament would find its negotiating strength with the central Westminster government significantly weakened. Sovereignty comes at a huge cost. Independence, rather less so. So as we see with the situation in Ukraine, sovereignty is not quite it's all cracked up to be. It's both a right and it's a power, but it's only genuinely a power when that power is equal to that of any other power that it runs up against. In international politics, as we know, this is rarely ever the case. Hence the questionable relevance of trying to recast international politics in terms of ideal conceptions of law and rights and talking about a right to secession. Thank you. Questions?
Again.
Hello.
I graduated from the University of Oxford.
Oh yes, indeed. We've met.
Thank you for your speech, and I just want to ask you, what's your opinion on the, on the China issue, for example, in Xinjiang province and in Tibet?
Yeah.
Like those people, they cannot vote,
yeah.
So they probably choose to fight. You know, so like, what do you think is the solution for this?
Yeah. Well, they may well choose to fight, but in the end, the question will be whether or not that will benefit them. I mean, if one looks at the geographical position of Xinjiang province, it's got to live with its big near neighbor, one way or the other. And the point I was making about secession is that secession kind of works when you have the backing of those who will recognize your rights. Now, who would be the beneficiaries of Uyghur secession? I mean, it's a landlocked state. It's wedged between Russia on the top and China and where else. Its access to the wider world is rather constrained. So here you have precisely the case of a sort of claim for national self-determination, which couldn't properly be exercised without the cooperation of its neighbors. So fight, you won't have the cooperation of your neighbors. What is the interest of your neighbors recognizing your independence, without wishing to disparage any Uyghurs in the audience? Nil, there's no international interest in seeing that, except were some Western powers, as in the 19th century, to try and weaken China by diverting its attention to secession. So it's a non-viable project. It's ambiguous whether it could even work as a state, because it's not an ethnically unified community. Large-scale Han Chinese immigration, complex history, it's on the border of there isn't a simple nation there to create the argument for a nation state, and it would need backers and support in close proximity, so the answer is no. Its best bet is to seek some kind of regional autonomy within a stable and secure federation in China. And that seems to be, the only genuine option for it. The West has no interest, or any other power has no interest in seeing that situation develop in a conflictual way. And probably those who have a personal interest in engaging in conflict with the wider population don't have sufficient support within the wider community for that to be sustained and effective over a long period anyway. There's not going to be a national uprising or anything like that.
Then what about Taiwan? If there is a referendum of secession on Taiwan, do you think there will be recognition from the international community?
Well, I mean, it's a complex question, because in principle the answer there could be yes, because it is in a different geographical position. So you could conceive of circumstances in which other powers had an interest in Taiwan being separate. My sense is that is unlikely, in that Taiwan's significance was considerable to the West, and here just talking about Western powers, whilst mainland China was weak. As mainland China becomes, well, it isn't weak now, it's second largest economy in the world, it makes all our stuff. If we have to make a choice, it's pretty clear what the choice is. I mean, you see that in terms of the recent visit of a very, very junior figure in the Obama administration to Taiwan. Now, it's a big issue because it's the first time anyone from the government has gone to Taiwan for a long time. But just look at the standing of that figure. It's not at the secretary level, it's a junior undersecretary. Okay, the sort of person who would come to Britain and not be noticed in the national press, and the sort of person who probably comes in the dozen to mainland China, again without getting much significant coverage, because the people who are important, the president, secretary of state, a handful of others, Secretary of Defense. That's big news, but you know, undersecretaries for education probably come quite a lot, don't get noticed. So given a choice, who would we recognize, who would we side with? All of the advantage is with Taiwan. But on the issue of whether Taiwan itself would decide to be different, I mean, that's a complex question. I remember when somebody came to talk about that at the London School of Economics, and they were sort of saying how, you know, Taiwan is different and it's not, you know, it's not China, it has a... And one of the students in the audience said, well, in that case, can we have all our stuff back? Because the National Museum in Taipei has the contents of the Forbidden City, effectively. Now, that isn't an assertion that they are China. They may be in a different status at the moment, but it is a recognition that the majority population sees some relationship with mainland China as the future. I think you know, that probably answers the question. You're right, you know, in principle, it's a much more realistic case than Xinjiang, but it isn't very realistic. And the circumstances of the rise of mainland China and the West's interest in that, which is the important thing, changes that completely.
My question is, do Scottish general public, especially the national section, regard the referendum without commitment as unconstitutional, or do they have any criticism?
I mean, Scotland is divided because the nationalist party has made a very legalistic case for the secessionist referendum. So it has gone out of its way to make this a territorially delimited referendum rather than a referendum based on national or, you know, ethnic connections. So there is this issue about whether Scots living outside of Scotland should have postal votes or recognition in the referendum. And the Scottish Parliament, dominated by the Nationalists, has said no. Now, their argument is that the referendum just looks more respectable if it is a territorially constituted element. And their point is to say that Scotland is effectively a state, which is a territorially constituted political community, not just a nation. If it's just a nation, then there are other ways in which you can accommodate national aspirations. But their claim is that they're also a state, so they can have a certain element of multiculturalism, they can have settled immigrant communities and so on, all of whom can be Scottish, okay, even if their family origin is in Pakistan or Bangladesh or south of India or Hong Kong or anywhere else, they can be Scottish. Whereas the argument that Scots, wherever they are, should have a vote makes that claim more nationalistic, culturally nationalistic, and therefore weakens it in the eyes of the state. So the party is very comfortable with this territorial, because the point is this suggests that they're a grown-up political community. When they make the claim to be a political community, not a national ethnic community, then they have a claim to statehood. But as I say, drawing a state boundary in a very small, although relatively densely populated set of islands, where families are distributed for all manner of reasons across this very small space, whether that will work, we shall see. But I can see why they've done it, and in a way it reflects the experience of Quebec in Canada. When the Quebec separatists, the Parti Québécois, emphasized their political readiness to be a state, they wished to separate themselves from focus on language recognition, the Francophone and Catholic heritage that Quebec grew out of. But every time they come to a referendum, that spills out, and then people feel uncomfortable that this is an ethnically exclusive view, and they vote against secession, which is what has happened in Quebec. Now, Scotland's nationalists have probably looked at that and decided that a civic case, a political case, is the stronger one. But actually, the benefits of having a referendum and not winning, as Quebec shows, they're also quite strong, because the Parti Québécois keeps winning elections, keeps losing referendums, but gets greater powers from the rest of Canada because the interest is to keep you in. Once you're in the position of going, your bargaining disappears, and then all the costs fall on you. So, you know, if there was a yes vote to go, then the rest of the British state would hammer the nationalist government in terms of the division of the national debt, access to the common currency, all the things that states need to be successful. They don't have to trade on, they don't have to concede on. At the moment they concede, Scotland gets a lot of benefit. Once they have a yes vote to go, then they're in trouble. Their bargaining power is weaker, and you see that in the situation in Quebec.
Good evening, and thank you for your remarks. My question is, could you maybe share your views on the relationship of China and Russia and how the incident of Crimea affects that? I'm asking on the background that it seems that in the United States there's a growing concern that a conflict between the West and Russia inevitably brings together China and Russia as partners.
Yeah.
At the same time, though, it cannot be in the interest of China to create a precedent for ethnically based succession.
As
we saw in Georgia.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't do more than just speculate, but my sense is that the Chinese regime is not clear how to respond to these kinds of challenges. The most important thing is that it is not in favor of secessions being effective. Okay? But if you think about it, from the perspective of Russia, it will recognize that counter-secession as an anti-secessionist move in a way undermines the argument of secession, and that doesn't do them any harm either. So to hold that threat of secession facing counter-secessions and so on undermines the claim of secessionist movement. So in that sense, it has a shared interest in a sense in the Russian strategy succeeding, holding the line and making sure that stability is retained. In the longer term, of course, China and Russia share certain common features as effectively imperial states with large territories, difficult to manage, and contested boundaries. But some of those boundaries are contested between Russia and China as well. So that's a difficult issue. But in a sense, its choice on this question is not that difficult, because the choice between the US and Russia effectively is the same. It's against secession as a movement. I mean, the US would rather that it hadn't found itself in the current situation. It's doing all it can to lend support to Ukraine, short of actually doing anything. And it doesn't want to do anything, and this is not something that it can do anything about, and it knows that. So in the, you know, the corridors of power, the real issue is going to be how to get back to the sort of status quo as quickly as possible, and that could involve, you know, sort of three-way recognition of stability as being the primary consideration here. But secessionist movements, the claims that will follow from recognition of this, all of these things are going to be a primary concern to China, and the interesting thing here is that they will eventually force China to take more of a role in international affairs, more of a role than it currently feels comfortable doing in terms of asserting its position in international affairs. It does a certain amount of that regionally, but doesn't yet want to, by all relevant measures, want to assert its power as a global player, but it is, and it will have to, and that will happen. And the US is watching China, China is watching the US, both are watching Russia, Putin is uncertain about what will happen on either side. And to be honest, for everybody, it is guesswork how this will pan out over the next few years. Ukraine will stay where it is, Ukraine will stay independent, it may end up with its borders being slightly changed, it will have some pressure on it to change its constitution in various kinds of ways, but it isn't moving. You know, there's nowhere for it to go, and there's no interest in this really developing much further. So once, you know, we can get over that, and time will be the key, some kind of settlement between those three core powers will kick in. But the interesting thing will be how the experience shapes the way China sees itself as an actor in the global sphere, and whether this forces it earlier than it had hoped to become a globally engaged power.
Thank you very much. I'm a second year student of the PKU LSE dual degree program in international affairs, and I was wondering what do you think it teaches us about nationalism, that now it seems like the British nationalists are caught in a somewhat ironic situation, that on the one hand they fend off the rally against the Scottish nationalists, but on the other hand they seem to be using the Scottish nationalist argument when on their side arguing against European Union influence on the UK.
Yeah.
How do you make sense of that?
I don't. I have no idea what's going on. Well, I mean, one interesting thing, I mean, the relationship between Britain and the European Union, which would be complicated further should Scotland actually secede from the Union, because whether Scotland would then have the benefits of EU membership or whether it would have to negotiate those, and what would the views of all the other member states be on having a new, small, insignificant and beneficiary of EU largesse rather than contributor, is an interesting question. But the idea of nationality and its impact on the European Union as a super state challenging British national identity and so on, it gets a lot of press coverage, but even at the height of the United Kingdom Independence Party's poll rating, it looks like it's capturing 20% of the electorate. 20% of the electorate distributed across the entire country, many of whom won't vote. So in the long run, it doesn't really, its voice doesn't really reflect the settled views of a country that once it has to recognize its national interest will quickly move away from these worries about ethnicity and national identity and the dangers of foreigners diluting that identity, and instead the longer term interests, economic interests and political interests of the British will continue to see Europe as a significant partner, put it that way. So I hear what you say, but I think it's all sort of epiphenomenal, it's all froth rather than, a substantial issue. And I think it also reflects back on the way the Scottish nationalists have tried to make their case, which is to be different from that, different from a small nation. They want to be inclusive, open, citizenship would be available to all sorts of immigrants, and Europe would be an advantage, not a problem. They're trying to make the case that they're a mature political community that can be a state rather than an oppressed nation whose culture is being challenged by this big neighbour across the border. So in a way, the UK Independence Party in relation to Europe is making the case for threat to culture. The nationalists in Scotland are trying to assert a positive case about political maturity. And I think that's an interesting point. But within the nationalists in Scotland, of course, there are these people who are cultural nationalists and who will be much less comfortable with all of this. So it would be interesting to see how Scotland would relate to the European Union if it were an independent state seeking accession to the Union, whether or not the nationalist community would then start to disaggregate into cultural and political nationalists. But I don't take the cultural nationalism of the British that seriously. One of the things about the British nation is that it isn't really a nation, and it's pluralistic, and people argue with each other and don't take strong conceptions of nation terribly seriously. It's a guess, and the way things are going, I wouldn't want to make a very strong claim. But my answer would be no and no. I think it's hard to see what interest Russia would have in a civil war on its border that close. The Russian population of Ukraine as a whole is only about 30-something percent. So although in pockets it's very, very concentrated, in parts of the east, in Crimea it's hugely concentrated, it is dispersed. Ukraine has a very, very large army, a big chunk of which was the former Soviet army, so it has manpower and it has resources. Russia has interests to see weakened. It will not want a military conflict in and around the Crimea where its Black Sea Fleet is based. So I think they may be provocative, and Russia will support eastern Ukrainian nationalist groupings up to a point, but once it ceases to be in Russia's interest, Putin has shown all the evidence that he can be particularly ruthless with his own people. So I think Putin will push this as far as he needs to go, but he will not allow a Ukrainian civil war, because there's no interest that serves for him. So I don't think there will be further secessions. My sense is that his interest is putting pressure on the Ukrainians to concede to a much more federalist constitution, which gives much greater regional power and protections. And in those circumstances, it's not impossible that Putin allows Crimea to remain part of that federation. So although they have recognized the referendum, it's not obvious that they will recognize it in particular ways, keeping Crimea as independent. So if there was a strongly federalist constitutional settlement, then I can see that Russia would strongly support it. So there's a lot of pressure there, but I just don't think they have an interest in a war or in further secession. Crimea, if you look at a map of Crimea, it's effectively an island. It's surrounded by water, except for a tiny isthmus. Historically, it's not obviously part of Ukraine. It doesn't have its resonance in Western Ukrainian history. It's only been part of the Republic since 1954 anyway. I can't really see that the same thing could be done with the other parts of eastern Ukraine. And then the problem would be, of course, you have a very small Russian population throughout the whole of Ukraine, which would be put at risk. So you have concentrations in big eastern cities, but you have Russians in Ukrainian cities like Kiev and so on, who would be at considerable peril. And Putin is not going to invade Ukraine. He will invade small countries and trouble, North Ossetia and threaten, Georgia. Ukraine is a different matter.
Thank you very much for talking, Dr. Kelly. I'm from Xue, the graduate student of the My question is about, you mentioned one possible scenario, called the referendum, the cause of only the federal government of the United Kingdom, they will get more autonomy from London, and London will definitely delegate or building to give some power to the emperor without compromise on the currency, more important, defense. Let's set a model for the, you know, for the some, you know, the power, say, in the central of the government to, you know, to give some concession to the subordinate powers who try to exercise their right of self-determination.
Well, I mean, it depends what you mean by self-determination. I mean, if self-determination is short of full sovereignty, you know, full responsibility for your economic position in relation to your currency and defense and so on, then there is the possibility for greater regional self-determination within Britain. In a way, that would actually be quite a good thing, partly because the current state is so heavily dominated by the economic power of London that, you know, there is a feeling throughout the British Isles that London distorts the politics of Britain, and therefore regional devolution and power would be much more important, would be much more attractive. And I think that's a long-term process that has been taking place within the British Constitution over 30, 40 years now, and that will continue. That's why I don't think that Scotland, in the end, will secede, because it loses those benefits. And secondly, because it can gain much of the benefits of greater self-determination by staying within and negotiating within the Union than stepping out. And I think that's an interesting lesson for other regions. You do see some of that in the circumstances of Quebec politics, for example, where the Quebec community have recognized that they have some benefits from staying within Canada, but they have considerable advantages by being able to negotiate very strong separation of various powers and so on. What they don't have to do is to share the national debt. And that's a hugely important issue. So there are advantages, and self-determination within states can be an attractive way of accommodating the mature claims of people to be self-governing, to own the decisions that are made about them in terms of their governance. And all regimes face that challenge. China will face that too. However it does it, it's going to have to find ways in which the people who bear the burdens of policies and legislation that, you know, can recognize those as legitimate in the sense of being their policies that in some sense come from sources of power that they recognize as being valuable or taking account of their interests. All regimes have that, and as they develop, it becomes more important. Does it involve separation, self-determination, secession, and sovereignty? No, those are all separate concepts that don't have to be run together. And I think that's the important lesson.
My question is, how does the purpose of secession affect the outcome? Because when you talk about Quebec or Scotland, the purpose of secession is for more independence.
Yeah.
Whereas when it came to Ukraine, the referendum was for reunification.
Yeah.
And I feel one of the reasons as to why the Chinese government seems to be on the fence on this issue, because while it can be seen as a referendum for reunification, it would be pro-Taiwan reunification of the mainland. But it can also mean pro-independence or pro just simply secession from the mainland.
Yeah.
So how does the purpose of secession affect this sort of process?
Well, I think the key issue here is whether or not, I mean, the important point is in a sense captured in your question, whether or not the issue of Ukraine is genuinely an issue of secession. Now, the question that was asked suggests no. That's the whole point about reunification. Although it was reunification on both sides, so there is an element of fairness. The second version was reunification with Ukraine in accordance with the 1994 constitution. So there's an implicit recognition that the current regime is illegitimate and that real Ukraine is captured in this earlier constitutional settlement, and it is that they would be staying with. So the interesting thing is whether this is an issue of secession at all. And I think you know, in a way, that's a language of discourse that's been imposed on the Crimean situation in an unhelpful way, and it's something that the relevant powers are having to deal with to either show that it's not really secession, I think that is the claim that the Russians are making, or that it's something that they can accommodate. But of course, there's, you know, there's problems in the national polities who are having to do this, who see secession in different kinds of ways. Now, I think, you know, the position is actually similar in terms of China and the United States, and both are militantly opposed to the idea of secession for strong historical reasons, civil wars effectively, and therefore, you know, secession is not something that they're prepared to compromise. That would undermine the integrity and legitimacy of the state. So the key point is to change the conversation, but how to do that is a difficult one, because secession is the way in which this is being described, and of course a lot of people within Ukraine are happy to use that because they are worried about the territorial integrity of their state and unilateral votes to leave. In Scotland, you know, it is a vote for independence. As I say, whether that becomes an issue of secession is the next stage. It's not actually the stage we're at the moment, and I suspect once it becomes an issue of operationalizing a vote to leave, it will become much more complex. And if you think back even to British history, to the early part of the 20th century, where there was a similar process of devolution which led to a request for, or a claim for separation through secession, you ended up with an extraordinarily bloody civil war, which lasted quite a long time, and that's the situation in Ireland. So, secession is something that, you know, I think many in international politics would like to see sort of excluded from the lexicon. It would help China, it would certainly help lots of other regimes if other ways of characterizing the claims for self-determination and the accommodation of those claims could be looked at.
My question is about that China is against the Crimean referendum, and also in the meantime, the Chinese government agreed that the Russian army be stationed in Crimea. So
yes.
I want to know that what's going on about it, and the reason that why the Chinese government is doing that.
Well, I mean, I can see why the Chinese government is against the Crimean referendum for secession, because, I mean, there was no legal provision for the referendum on secession or the referendum in Crimea anyway under the Ukrainian constitution. So in that sense, it's illegal. And of course, what would be at the back of the Chinese regime's mind would be what would happen if, say, Hong Kong independently decided to have a non-binding but nevertheless opinion-gathering referendum on separation. I mean, it's pretty obvious what the central government's view would be. So it's trying to discourage the idea that aspirant separate statelets, you know, can simply assert their claim to independence. And that's the interesting thing about Scotland. Scotland was just going to do it anyway. And in a way, if they're determined to do it, unless you have the confidence in terms of exercising political military power, you're confronted with the problem of what you do. Ukraine couldn't do anything against Crimea because of the base of Russian troops. So there was no way they were going to invade Crimea to stop the referendum. They would have confronted the Russian military, and those little confrontations that took place showed that that was never going to happen. China might be happier to assert its authority over small, you know, groups that decide they're going to have a referendum. Britain invading Scotland, well, actually, you know, a good chunk of the British army comes from Scotland anyway. historically, just as before that, it used to come from Ireland. It's not obvious which way the British Army would go. So the issue there is, in a way, it's a sensible political calculation. What's the benefit and burden of allowing this to continue? Does it create a problem for us in Britain? The problem is much less by just allowing it to go ahead and then saying things like, yes, but you can't have the pound, you won't have the cover of security and defence, we'll stop investing in Scottish bases and so on. And that's a big worry. There's huge communities in Scotland who depend on the British military for their economic survival. Scotland doesn't have much by way of population. But if, on the other hand, you're a powerful state and you can flex your power relatively easy just by threatening, so just by being huge on the border of Hong Kong, you can stop Hong Kong doing something like this. Or even Taiwan, which is further away and bigger, you know, you can just make it clear that this would not be a good idea without actually having to stop it. So you make a judgment based on your power. China is just kind of powerful at the moment. Any more questions? Brendan, wind up. Thank you very much, anyway.